You're listening to Radio Aryan.
Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, you vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be. In the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One word more for signal token, whistle up the marching tune. For your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon. With your pike upon your shoulder.
Greetings from the Northwest homeland, comrades. The date is Thursday, December 6th, 2018. I'm Andy Donner, and you're listening to Radio Free Northwest.
For the blessed warming light, farmers passed along the valleys like the banshee's lonely croon, and the thousand blades were flushing at the rising of the moon. At the rising of the moon, at the rising of the moon.
All right, everybody. I need to make an announcement, a couple of quick observations, and then dash. For the next month or so, I'm going to be especially busy focusing primarily on admin work rather than content production. There are lots of comrades helping me out with the show in the meantime, and I will make sure to make appearances as needed. Lord Lucan sent me something last week which he wants passed along to, well, everyone. He sent me the teaching of an unnamed rabbi that said, well, basically what self-defense really is. Self-defense, according to the unnamed rabbi, is the right to put a stop by whatever means necessary to the plans of anyone who intends you harm, even if that harm is not imminent. And like everything else Jews do, it's an exact reverse. You see, they're the ones causing the problems, not the other way around. Trucker, in the last RFN episode, asked my reaction to a particular ballot measure involving firearms, their sale, and storage that was recently passed here in Washington State. And truth be told, this is very similar to another item of firearms legislation that was passed here in Washington State in the 2012 election. Every single liberal gun legislation option that becomes available is, well, pretty much equally inane. What could we learn from this? These sorts of things are going to keep happening and keep happening until we stop them. That is the real takeaway from the trucker's presentation. The trucker was completely right to have the reaction he had. I could legitimately have exactly this reaction to anything any white nationalist presents me with at any point. Basically, white nationalism, outside of the Northwest Imperative, is everyone just perpetually having this reaction. At this point, it's absolutely meaningless, because everyone knows what the solution is. It's the Northwest Imperative. It's the Butler Plan. Harold Covington spoke at length regarding the subject of Class A's in the first 2 years of Radio Free Northwest. Throughout the years, I've been involved with the party, and during my time on Radio Free Northwest, I have frequently, very frequently, in fact, had cause to point out that there are consequences to waiting. Those Class A's among you hearing my voice right now will implicitly understand that there is no single election, no single person, or even a series of elections or a group of politicians that in any way has the ability to reverse our racial problems. And the sooner we accept that, the sooner we can get on board with what will work. The key difference is that the Class A's among us need to do what the party asks, come home, get involved, and create an independent, sovereign, all-white nation here in the Pacific Northwest. It's that or bust. We need to actually apply what we know. Someone who's busy applying knowledge can't have this reaction because they're focused on doing something rather than venting. Can someone who's reacting to that gun legislation or that pervert parade or that transgender bathroom policy or this illegal alien voting, can any of those people reacting to that truly say they're applying what they know? Of course they can't. In order for someone to apply knowledge, especially correctly, they have to be so familiar with that knowledge that they're no longer surprised when some facet of it, such as news items that white nationalists dislike, presents itself to them. The few times I've shared my own homecoming story on Radio Free Northwest, I've made it a point to emphasize that I didn't always do everything I should have at each particular juncture, otherwise I probably could have been here far sooner than I was. Ultimately, that clearly didn't matter because I decided to take care of business. And in precisely that same vein, I need to take a step back for a little bit to focus on things that, quite frankly, I should have done better and things I should have been better prepared for, just like my own migration. I want to make it very clear that my previous failures didn't have to define me because I didn't let them define me. We all know that each and every one of you as individuals is fully cognizant of the fact that you need to come home and participate in the Northwest Imperative to your utmost ability. Previous failures to do so, quite frankly, can be made non-existent by earnestly applying what you know to be true. I personally don't have a whole lot for you this week, since, again, I am focusing on some administrative things for the time being, so I'm going to hand the show off to a comrade who has been on RFN before, all the way back in 2012, and who finally managed to find his way to the homeland this past summer. Here's Comrade Jason.
Greetings to my fellow white patriots. My name is Jason, and this will be my reintroduction to Radio Free Northwest after an absence of over 6 years. I was last on RFN for one show in July of 2011 and on shows in April and July of 2012. It's been a long time since I recorded my last submission to RFN, but in the intervening years I have maintained active association with the Front and supported our efforts in several ways. For a little over 2 years, I was the Front's main video creator. I also wrote a couple of propaganda pamphlets that were well received by Herald and are still in use by the Front. And like every other member of the current headquarters group, I served as one of Harold's editors for his final Northwest novel, Freedom's Sons. When I was first included on RFN 6 years ago, Harold introduced me as Comrade Jason from Oklahoma, and so I will continue using the moniker that Harold set for me. However, I am now Comrade Jason from Washington. I came home to the future Northwest American Republic during this past summer, about 5 months ago, and settled here in the Northwest Front's General Headquarters region in the greater Seattle metropolitan area. I seem to have the distinction of being the last migrant to come home before Harold's untimely death in July. Many of you are aware that, as a basic security measure, the party has an established process for vetting new people before they are allowed close involvement with the Front. Although my own work for the party was well known and extensive, I was still, and correctly, put through this process upon my arrival. Once I was settled in after my move, I contacted Harold and a meeting was arranged. Over a 4-hour dinner, I was vetted personally by our new party spokesman, Andy Donner, who gave me a solid upcheck and green-lighted me for a meeting with Mr. Covington. I was within perhaps 4 days of finally meeting Harold, the man who had renewed my faith in the possibility of a white future worth having, when he died on July 17th. As might be imagined, this was an incredible disappointment for me. Throughout 2017 and into 2018, I became very aware of a voice in the back of my mind, becoming ever more insistent, that told me I needed to get up here as soon as I could if I were going to have my chance to work in person with Harold, and to be able to learn the inside details and wisdom to be gained from his many years fighting for our people in America, Rhodesia, and in Europe. Alas, that was not to be. I suppose the lesson to be learned is, as Andy already mentioned in his segment, there is often a cost to waiting to do the things you know you should already be doing. As Andy also mentioned, the rest of the headquarters group is going to be supporting him by taking over editing and production of RFN for December. As we discussed with you in the October organizational letter, also read by Comrade Don on RFN, the HQ group has been meeting frequently to map out the future direction of the Front, and I'm pleased to share with you some of our current thinking. Andy gave a preview earlier with his reference to the Class A's that Harold said would be needed to create the racial states that are the only long-term survival solution for the uniquely valuable white subspecies of humanity. I say racial states, plural, because I personally believe there will eventually be several white racial states established around the world, either new ones or white nations that understand they must expel non-whites and once again govern for their own people in order to avoid being plunged into chaos and ultimately racial and cultural death. The realization of the need for a return to exclusively white nations for the preservation of white humanity is growing, and it is certainly not unique to us, nor unique to American white racial patriots. But the Front is unique in having chosen the correct place on the North American continent for such a state, and for having begun to galvanize and collect a dedicated cadre of people who can bring it into reality. Much to the dismay of our racial enemies and the white race traitors whom they emotionally control, there will be white racial states established purposefully by intent on this earth. The way I think of it is that there's absolutely zero chance that the white race will not ultimately fight for its own survival. And truly, how can we not win when the wheels are set in motion? The white race conquered the entire world, and when the battle is ultimately joined, the enemy will be weakened at its core by multiracialism, a problem that only grows worse, never better. We will fight to survive, and we will win. It will be done somewhere, and it most certainly can be done here. The Class A's, those here now and those to come, and all who work in support of them will make it happen. In furtherance of meeting the need, the party has decided to refocus on recruitment of these types. Indeed, Harold's identification of the Class A's and his call either to find them or to grow them from within our own ranks made perfect sense to me and was absolutely one of my motivating factors for coming into active support of the Northwest Front. In that vein, I'm going to rerun Harold's explanation of just who the Class A's are and whom each of us needs to become if we want to maximize our own personal potential in the fight for a better white future. This was actually rebroadcast a couple months ago, by coincidence and for other reasons, in a full show rerun that Andy put out. However, longtime listeners will know the importance of spaced repetition, and it is germane to this discussion that we be reminded. You will be pleased to hear that I have cut the original down to the essentials for efficiency. Here's Harold.
All right, next email is from Lee in Arizona. Dear Mr. Covington, in your latest copy of the White Nationalist email list, you mentioned that you wanted 1,000 Class A's to come to you in the Pacific Northwest, and from them you would give us the Northwest Republic. Please define exactly what you mean by Class A's. Surely, although this impinges on that area where people start screaming, "No, no, Harold, you mustn't talk about these things in public!" Yep, it's our old friend the character issue again. Well, all I can say is that we've been not talking about these things in public for the past 50 years now, and we can all see what a brilliant success that strategy has been. For those of you who are unfamiliar with what Lee's referring to, about once or twice a week for the past several months, I've been sending out a list of people who are willing to publish their email addresses for the purpose of making contact and eventually meeting in person with other white nationalists in their areas. The idea is to try and get this white thing at least somewhat off the internet and back into the real physical world. So far, out of a list of approximately 1,800 email addresses, we have gotten all of 100 white people who are willing to step forward and physically meet someone else off the internet. Or so they say. It's taken us about 4 months to do that. Every time I send out the list, one or two more people see the beginnings of a crowd that they can hide in, and they're emboldened to peep timidly out from behind their computers and add their names to the list. Anyway, in one of my introductions to a recent edition of the White Nationalist email list, I repeated something that I've said on this show on several prior occasions, i.e., give me 1,000 Class A people here in the Northwest and we'll win. And Lee wants me to define what I mean by Class A person. Okay, here's a kind of a thumbnail sketch of the kind of person we need to come here and fight for white freedom in the homeland. The first requirement is that a Class A person be white. Now, that may sound silly, but I assure you it's a criterion we need to establish from the get-go. Now, I'm not going to go off into one of these long, abstruse debates involving 19th century racial theory about who is white. I favor the 30-second test. If there's any doubt in your mind at all after 30 seconds when you meet someone for the first time, then it's probably best to take a pass on that person. Trust your racial instincts. But I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about a very bad movement tendency to try and use or get mileage out of Jews and half-Jews, niggers and demi-niggers, gooks and bugger boys. We try to draw strength of numbers and strength of character from these people because we ourselves have so little of it, because our Aryan blood has become so thinned out and watered down in both the physical and the metaphysical sense. We become such weaklings that we try to lean on the strength of our enemies. We no longer have the inner strength of our ancestors. Help, 1,700 of us out of 1,800 are too terrified even to post our email addresses in public. So we try to leech off and lean on the courage and strength of some of these non-white groups that still have some. Believe it or not, there are some groups like the BNP in England and certain other European so-called nationalist groups who have made an actual policy out of this, who allow all of these kinds of non-white and degenerate people I just mentioned into their organization and into their homes and use them in their political work. I have seen actual campaign literature with a BNP local council candidate proudly posing for a photo with his racially mixed grandchildren, not to mention a recent website describing the BNP in Israel as quote-unquote comrades in arms. There is in fact a name for this. It's called movement modernization, which effectively speaking means accepting Jews as white and homosexuals as tolerable so long as they're discreet. We do have a few so-called racist groups in our country like that. One in particular springs to mind, but that's a topic all unto itself, which I'm not going to get into now. Just for the record, though, no, the Northwest Federalist Front is not, quote-unquote, modernized in that sense. Guys, we're doing what we're doing for whites only. If we're going to admit non-whites and perverts and so-called good Jews as some kind of allies or try to borrow from them some of the strength of character which our own people lack, then what the hell is the point in doing any of this? It would be an admission that we really have nothing worth saving of our own. And whether or not that's the case, it's not something I ever intend to concede in public. So that's the first requirement for a Class A Northwest independence activist. This Northwest thing of ours is a whites-only gig. The second requirement is that a Class A needs to be a pretty sharp individual. No American dumbasses need apply. I don't mean he or she has to have a genius-level IQ. I don't mean that he or she has to have a college degree. Considering the state of most colleges and universities these days, that wouldn't be much of a recommendation anyway. No, a Class A white nationalist has something which millions of white people, especially millions of young white people, no longer have, and that's the ability to think rather than to feel. If you watch TV at all, you will notice that usually when some media person type is interviewing some average Joe the Plumber or Marge Simpson character, the media guy will ask, how do you feel about thus and such, not what do you think about it? The Class A white nationalist, more often than not, is someone who has come to their racial conclusions more or less independently on their own and not because they were raised in it by their families, which is something that seldom happens anymore. Indeed, that's one of our problems. White children no longer get any kind of racial or moral ethics instilled in them by their materialistic American parents, and they're forced to go looking on the internet and elsewhere for answers to their questions about the world and why it is the way it is. All too often, they find the wrong answers. A Class A white nationalist is someone who is capable of investigating and determining why the world is the way it is for themselves, and who is capable of assimilating and accepting the fact that the Northwest migration is the only solution. A white nationalist who knows his Jews and his Bilderbergers and who has all kinds of knowledge about the problem but who doesn't get the solution, somebody who still thinks there's some way we can make all our problems vanish in a puff of smoke without ever pulling a trigger, someone who wants to restore the world to the Brady Bunch without any bloodshed or risk or effort, well, somebody like that can't really be called a Class A, maybe a Class B nationalist. Understanding the problem is getting there, a big part of it, but it's only the first step. You've got to understand the solution as well. Now, third, a Class A person of the kind I'm talking about must be functional in society. He or she has to be able to come here off their own bat and under their own steam. They have to be able to acquire and set up a home in the homeland, and they must be able to obtain and hold gainful employment or self-employment and support themselves financially because, quite frankly, we can't help them at this time, and we won't be able to do so for quite a while. There will come a time when new migrants can be assisted, both physically and financially, and they can be given concrete help in finding such things as housing and employment. Now, that time is not yet, because we don't have enough Class A's currently resident in the homeland. Now, that's another mark of a Class A Northwest pioneer. He or she understands that they are going first, that there is no safety net as yet, and that part of their task will be to get settled in and begin weaving the safety net for those who will come after. Now, there will be a time for the T-shirt youth, the young men, and nowadays a few young women, with nothing but the T-shirts on their backs. There will come a time when we can provide a bunkhouse and a fridge, although there won't be any beer in the fridge, and it won't be an Aryan Nation-style deal where they just lounge around flashing their tats and posing for the cameras. There won't be any cameras, and when they do come, the T-shirt youth will be kept so busy by the party that they won't have time to do much sleeping in that bunkhouse. A lot of all that trouble they used to have up at Hayden Lake was due to the devil making work for idle hands, and that's a problem that the Northwest Front can't allow to arise, but for the time being, new pioneers have to come here under their own steam and using their own assets. Now, another thing, Class A Northwest activists must be unencumbered and completely free to make a lifelong commitment to the cause of Northwest independence. Now, by that I mean they must not be embroiled in the 1001 nasty, annoying, and draining little dysfunctional life situations that white people in America seem prone to get themselves into these days. I've already mentioned that Class A people must be economically self-sufficient and not dependent on the party, since we can't house or support anybody, but there's much more than that. Class A's must not be in the middle of a nasty divorce or child custody battle. Class A's must not be on parole or probation. They must not be fighting some kind of nuisance lawsuit or legal case, especially they can't be involved in one of these endless criminal cases that the system specializes in. Now, they can't be on bail or on remand or on conditions in some legal mess that restricts their freedom of participation in political activity. Basically, Class A's must not be in any way, shape, or form entangled within the system's judicial judicial machinery. Ideally, they should be completely unknown to the system and off the radar, except possibly as an internet pseudonym. Class A white nationalists should ideally be young enough to have some tread left on the tire so that the term long haul actually means something. Now, I'm not knocking all you codgers and crones and coots out there. Remember, I'm one of you myself. But I say again, revolution is a young man's game, and the Tea Party notwithstanding, we cannot storm the barricades with some kind of geriatric mob in our wheelchairs and our walkers. We have got to get some young people and some medium young people, say 30-somethings, in on this. Neither can we storm the barricades while dragging one or two elderly parents or relatives after us in their wheelchairs and walkers. Okay, now I'm going to have to choose my words really carefully here because this is one of those topics where I'm going to get this business of, oh, Harold is talking bad about me. Harold is being mean and cruel. No, I'm not, but we have enough people who are in this situation so that every damned one of you is going to be sure that I'm talking about you personally, and I'm not. Are we clear on this? I'm not talking about any one person individually here. I'm talking about all of you, at least a couple of dozen individual cases to my knowledge. I'm referring to a phenomenon which is really starting to hold us up, and that's white nationalists in their 30s and 40s entering the best and most potentially productive years of their lives who have gotten stuck with taking care of the old folks, usually because the non-racist siblings simply refuse and dump it onto them, but sometimes because there's simply no one else and the alternative is a government-run nursing home, which is basically a form of managed death. Now, I'm not being mean and cruel here and suggesting that you dump daddy or meemaw in a home, okay? Are we clear on that? To be honest, I don't have a solution for that problem. It simply depends on what your own conscience will allow in your own individual situation. I'm simply making the practical observation that a Class A activist, in order to be considered a Class A, will somehow have managed to free up his time so that he's available for political work with the Northwest Front. A Class A activist can't be constantly leaving meetings early and missing activities and cutting back on party work in order to look in on and take care of an elderly relative. Now, this is just a fact of life. If you're in that position, then you're doing something honorable and noble. I get that, but we got to be honest and practical about this. I can't really give you a call and say, be on Interstate 5 at exit so-and-so at dawn tomorrow. The revolution begins. Because you may say, I can't make that. I have to cook breakfast for Meemaw. You see what I'm saying? A Class A revolutionary lives for the revolution.
So there we have it again, straight from the horse's mouth. A detailed description of the type of people who can and will bring a new all-white nation into being. I want to add some things to what Harold laid out and expand on a few of the things he has always said about the type of people we need. First of all, and above all else, is what Harold always referred to as the character issue. Now, I always appreciated his emphasis on this aspect of things, because this emphasis truly did, and continues to, set the front apart from almost every other group in the movement. However, the term character is a very broad, overarching term, and I was never quite satisfied that Harold gave enough detailed analysis on this topic to be of greatest use, especially to younger people, in how to gauge our personal progress and our progress as a movement in measuring up to the tasks that are ahead of us. So let's talk a little more specifically about which aspects of bad character are delaying and even may prevent our success and ultimate victory. When Harold railed against bad character and gave examples of it from his past involvement with the movement, it always seemed to me that the main thing he was talking about and the greatest deficiency that he saw in the movement was quite frankly a lack of maturity. Now, when we talk about the attributes that make a Class A revolutionary, maturity might seem to be a second-tier attribute to be concerned about. You might think we'd talk more about courage, both intellectual and physical, maybe. Perhaps we'd talk more about the willingness to commit to a cause and to take action, or maybe perseverance and dedication. But I'd have to say that while all of those are essential, if those are present in an individual without a fundamentally mature psyche, I'd say they're almost useless for any real party work over the long term. An immature individual will find a way to sabotage our efforts either through their own lack of discipline or ability to just work well with others. Only adults will be capable of pulling off the revolution. If we have a lot of emotionally juvenile people in our ranks that can't handle small disappointments in life, that have fragile egos, that are too dependent upon other people's good opinion of them, they will not be able to withstand any sort of assault from the enemy. Rhetorical assaults, physical assaults, threats from the law enforcement agencies that will look to suppress freedom and suppress the organization. We need people who are adults and who are resilient, capable of emotional control. If you're still in a place where other people can easily control your emotional state, and anytime anyone gets angry with you, you match that anger and give right back to them because you feel slighted and you can't really handle that, and so you have to strike out defensively, you have some growing up to do. Unless you can control your own mental and emotional state during times of stress, you're not going to be of much use to us or to the revolution. And the fact of the matter is, we still see too much immaturity in the correspondence received by email and other means. It's not an issue that's going to go away, but I'm looking to highlight the type of people we are looking for, and to reemphasize that the party will be paying closer attention to recruitment efforts, both nationally and, more importantly, on the local level, in our centers in the homeland especially.
Good evening, comrades. Tonight I'm going to be discussing "Twas a Good Fight, The Life of Colin Jordan" by Stephen L. Frost. Now, Jordan was the only child of academic parents. Jordan's father, Percy, had a PhD in political science, and his mother, Bertha, was a school teacher who loved genealogy. And according to Frost, she appears to have been a great influence in Jordan's political life. She was always helping him, even when he became involved in all sorts of legal and political difficulties. Now, Jordan was born in England in the summer of 1923, and all of his life he heard of the Great War, and he was horrified by the notion of whites fighting. By the late 1930s, Jordan developed an interest in the British Union of Fascists and also Adolf Hitler. And in 1937, Jordan spent 2 weeks living at the Anglo-Continental Family Center in Germany. And apparently, Jordan would often go to Germany during the summer months throughout his life. Now, when war broke out, Jordan answered the call, but he went into the medical and non-combat services. Jordan always remained friendly with various luminaries such as Winifred Wagner, the Hess family, and various former SS members. After the war, Jordan goes back to college in Sussex, and while he's there, he begins to correspond with a comrade by the name of Arnold Lees. This relationship steers him away from Mosley, and at around this time, Jordan would start a newsletter entitled Gothic Ripples, which would be an ongoing preoccupation. Jordan was a constant agitator for the cause during college, and he joined something called the Cambridge Union National Party. By 1946, he would also join the British People's Party, and also he got involved with the League of Empire Loyalists. He did become disillusioned with this group when he learned that they wanted to include colored persons. In 1959, Colin published a letter in the Leamington Courier entitled The Price of Colored Immigration. And in the early 1960s, Colin would start an organization called the Northern European Ring. Now, amazingly, by today's standards, in all of this, Colin had decided to follow in his mother's footsteps and become a school teacher. At first, he got away with this, but by early 1960, this arrangement was coming much into question. By 1962, Jordan's career in the movement was really taking off. For this was the year that Jordan got a postcard from Savitri Devi. It was also the year of the famous Cotswold Conference. And this was the conference where they drew up a series of criteria by which organizations could be judged in order to determine whether they were officially National Socialists. At this point, Collins' focus was a very overt expression of National Socialism that was very much Germanophilic, whereas the BNP catered to individuals that wanted to focus more exclusively on British identity, and they were sometimes termed Little Englanders. By September of 1962, Jordan would have much more time to devote to politics because at this point he had become involuntarily unemployed. And by the end of 1963, he would actually be kicked out of the school teachers' union and would be declared as an unfit teacher. Around this time, we see Jordan getting sucked into various legal issues. For one thing, he was said to have violated something called the Public Order Act, which seems to be a legal act that seems to have been made specifically for Colin Jordan because he was such a strong agitator. At around this time, perhaps because of romance, perhaps because of the financial problems brought about by his unemployment, he decides to marry the heiress to the Dior fortune. Now, there was much fanfare surrounding this wedding, as Jordan was very much someone that loved to be in the public eye and really knew how to cultivate the press. But unfortunately, these were two very strong personalities. And sadly, the marriage would not last long. Also, at around this time, around 1965, Britain ends up very much copying Lyndon Johnson's 1965 immigration bill. And perhaps because of this, National Socialists, probably all around the world, but certainly in Britain, started to fall into some panic. And some of them apparently become involved in the destruction of several synagogues. Apparently, Colin Jordan had nothing to do with this, but he's guilty by association, and he spends the rest of his life trying to clear his name. Now, by the late 60s, Colin becomes concerned that his organization is not as popular as he thinks it should be. And so he decides to rethink the various flags and costumes being used by his organization. And to this end, he also pulls out of the World Union of National Socialists that, of course, began at Coxwold. Now, this doesn't seem to please anyone. For people who are very hardcore, it disappoints them because they see it as becoming too mild. For others who are more mainstream, they see this sudden makeover as disingenuous. However, Colin decides to keep going with his strategic choice, and he starts a new organization called the British Movement. Now, Colin still wants to deal with weighty issues. He wants to deal with things like protesting the common market, and also he wants to be clearly anti-globalist, but he also wants to take a greater interest in local politics. Even so, continues to go abroad in the summer months, always going to Germany. And by 1975, for personal reasons, he decides to resign from the British Movement. Now, 5 years later, by 1980, Colin could see that demographics were changing, and he comes to realize that the electoral process is really useless. At this point, he has no more reason to continue to appear mainstream. And he once again returns to a more openly National Socialist declaration. At this point, he switches tactics from a political tactic to a much more cultural tactic, and he starts talking about the need for a vanguard and wanting to disrupt the status quo and actually start new communities. He keeps in touch with William Pierce and also various members of the order and their families, and he helps to support them financially as much as he can. He stays active even into his old age. He protests the imprisonment of Hess, and he also keeps the history of Hess in the public eye, and he brings to public attention the creation of the Hess Flight Memorial, and also brings to public attention the ultimate vandalism and destruction of this memorial. Now, throughout his life, Colin was harassed by the special branch, and he's always trying to get justice for this harassment, but more and more his ill health works against him. However, even in a frail, elderly state, he would continue his writing, and he becomes involved in, according to Frost, at least three publications. One of them called Uprising, another one entitled Merry England, and yet another called Black Sun. And apparently, he was also involved in some other writings as well. You can find at least one of his books on Amazon, but apparently it's really quite expensive. And he spends his last days really surrounded by various comrades and also encouraging anyone who agrees with him to take their place, as he puts it, in the battle for Britain. So I found this book, of course, very informative about the many years that Colin Jordan was active. And so I thank you very much for listening. Have a good evening and hail victory, comrades.
I have always valued Gretchen the Librarian's contributions to RFN tremendously. She always finds new and highly relevant and important works to share with the listenership, and I couldn't even tell you how many significant works that I have read which first came to my attention through her reviews on RFN. On behalf of the entire headquarters group, I want to appreciate Gretchen once again for her long dedication to the front and for her several hundred submissions to RFN that she has made over the years. They have been invaluable. Thanks again, comrade. No music selection for this week. Harold had his own eclectic musical style for the show, steeped in the various musical traditions of our people across the world, and it will take some doing to effectively match his knowledge and efforts there. I myself am not particularly musically inclined, but as regards music on RFN, we'll figure out what we want to do on that score soon. A bit more on current status and direction of the party. We have regained access to almost all email and online accounts, and certainly the most important, and we're looking at how to best reestablish regular electronic communication with everyone. As we heard many times from the old man himself, Harold was not the most tech-savvy, although I thought he did pretty well, all things considered. In the realm of contact with the front and the front's communications to you, he kept things somewhat close to the vest and had his preferred systems with which he was comfortable, but which were nowhere near optimal for long-term stability nor security from a technical standpoint. One of the nice things for us now is that we are no longer set in Harold's ways in this matter, and we are looking at the best ways to provide a better and more secure means of electronic communications. We're not there quite yet, but we will be soon. The front does have some high-powered computer talent available to us for this modernization process, and we can now make important changes in the technology arena that will greatly benefit the party in the years to come. Please continue to bear with us, as we are planning a return to regular and more personalized contact with the front, both for longtime associates and for all of you new people still sending us contact requests. We will have new capabilities ready before too long. We are still grappling with various government entities in the standard slow fashion of such things in the wake of Harold's death. As mentioned, there are some things only Andy can do, and I know all of you would be impressed and grateful for how much work he is putting in to address these critical needs while fulfilling the role as the party's general secretary in addition to his role as official spokesman. Final note for this show. The current state of RFN, the show's purpose, in the grand scheme of things, and its evolution. Some decidedly non-Class A types, with neither knowledge of the current situation nor the imagination to envision what the situation might be like at this time, have made some squawking noises over the current state of RFN. We understand why some of these noises would be made, and as with many things, the sentiments being expressed were not unexpected. They have, in fact, been disappointingly predictable. But really, it's quite okay. It's all good. What I will say is that one of the things we all liked so much about Herald was that while broadcasting cutting-edge social and racial commentary and inspiring us to rise to the defense of our race, he could be so darned entertaining in doing so. Herald had mastery of the written and spoken word, paired with the skill of a veteran broadcaster. The entertainment value of RFN, however, tended to blind some people to its true purpose. But RFN is not about entertainment. It is the central propaganda and educational vehicle for a serious party advocating serious change. Change which must be brought about to save real white lives, not only of the present day, but of untold numbers of future generations. And we must remember that. Hopefully this episode will serve to quiet some of the unease people may be feeling about our having to play so many reruns. Let me assure you, important work, more important work than RFN, was being done. We are now able to devote more attention and manpower to this program once again, but let me make it clear. RFN is here to serve the party's purposes, to serve the 14 words. However, it cannot and will not serve as a straitjacket to our time, energy, and efforts, which must be balanced against other priorities. RFN will evolve as the needs and focus of the mission evolve, as any tool or process should. The game is as it has always been and as it always will be. Adapt and survive. I think you understand me. So that's all I will say about that. We will have more original content next week. And quite frankly, we don't expect to have to rerun entire episodes anymore. We will see whether that holds, but don't have any doubt that the party and the headquarters group continue the work Harold Covington started. We serve the 14 words. We must secure the existence of our people and a future for white children. We must, and so we will. Have a great week, comrades. Thanks for listening.
Radio Free Northwest is brought to you by the Northwest Front, P.O. Box 2188, Bremerton, Washington, 98310. Or you can visit the party on our website at www.northwestfront.org. Until next week, freedom.
Oh, what glorious pride and sorrow fill the name of 98. Yet, thank God, it still is beating.